From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand in California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. The housing crisis helped propel this country into the worst recession in decades, and now we're seeing some tentative signs that the real estate market may be starting to recover. New numbers out today from a closely watched index show prices on the rise again, at least in some parts of the country, and that's on top of other recent data that also show more homes being sold. We asked our reporter Chris Arnold to put those numbers in context.
Boston, Charlotte, Chicago, Cleveland, Dallas, Minneapolis, and San Francisco. What do they have in common? They're cities where home prices rose recently. That's according to the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index.
This is the first time in almost 3 years that we've seen price increases. So when we see a break in the downward trend, that's definitely encouraging news.
That's Yale professor Robert Shiller. He helped to design the home price index. And for a long time, he was known as being a pessimist about the housing market. It turned out he was absolutely right. But now Shiller is striking a different tone.
Well, I think the worst is probably behind us, the worst pace of decline. We were going down at 2% a month for a number of months in a row. Nationally, that was really something. Now home prices relative to rents or construction costs are back at normal levels.
Shiller stresses that he does not think we're about to see another housing boom. During this downturn, we've seen record drops in prices. And when it comes to new homes, it's been more than 50 years since we were building and selling so few of them. But over the course of this spring, sales have been picking up.
So look at that. We got the Century 21 sign here with a nice sold tag on the bottom, huh?
That's always a pleasure to see.
Anita Shishmanian is a realtor who just sold a condo in the town of Belmont, so just outside Boston. This time last year, she'd have an open house, and it was like she was at a funeral for somebody with no friends or relatives. Just quiet and kind of depressing. But over the course of this spring, she's watched that change.
I had one not so long ago, a single-family home, and had an open house and was swamped with buyers, real swamped. At the end of the day, I had something like 5 offers come in. I certainly do sense a turn.
Shishmanian says she's had a bunch of open houses like that. And she says she's been selling more homes again. And that's finally starting to put a dent in the enormous glut of homes that have been sitting on the market.
Inventories are dropping. So when that happens, it's a pretty significant indicator that, you know, we're going to do a little bit of an upturn. Just to give you one number that I happen to remember from about this time last year, condos in one of the local towns was, there were about 140 of them on the market then. This year, there are about 89 condos on the market. That's good. We like to see that.
Yeah, I mean, as the supply drops, you know, the price can stabilize.
Right, exactly.
It's basic supply and demand. For a couple years, there were just way more houses than buyers. And finally, the inventory is thinning out a bit. Also, Shishmanian says an $8,000 tax credit for first-time homebuyers is enticing more people. So have we finally hit bottom for the housing market?
Well, I think it very much depends on what city you're in.
William Wheaton is a housing economist at MIT.
There are really two types of markets right now. There are markets where prices have taken a big plunge, 30-40%. So we'd certainly say California and Arizona and Florida.
Wheaton says in areas like that, half of all sales are foreclosure sales at fire sale prices. And a lot of people are able to get very good deals on houses.
If you're in a market like California where prices have fallen 50% and transactions have picked up, and you ask your friendly professor, is this the bottom? I would say, yeah, pretty much so. I would buy a house for, 50, 60% of what it was a few years ago, I'd buy it.
Wheaton says there are many other markets, though, where prices have not fallen by that much, and he thinks some could still drift lower. Also, of course, the local employment picture is really important. And a big wild card in all this, foreclosures. They've played a very big role in driving down prices and keeping the market depressed. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
David Wessel of The Wall Street Journal is a frequent guest on our program, and he's out with a new book. It's called In Fed We Trust, and it's about the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and his war on what Wessel calls the Great Panic, the financial meltdown, and the effort to prevent a second Great Depression. But Wessel tells a serious story as a kind of high-finance thriller filled with plot twists and unpredictable characters dashing around the elegant corridors of the Federal Reserve. Thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Now, your book is not a diatribe on how the U.S. economy got into this mess. It's about the rescue mission mounted by the Federal Reserve. And in your first chapter, you give us a quite dramatic account of why it nearly went completely astray, what you call the colossal mistake of allowing a major investment bank, Lehman Brothers, to fail.
Right. I think as we look back, we now know that that decision to allow Lehman Brothers to fail was, if not the catalyst for this terrible economic shock, at least a contributing factor.
Do you think that the group of people that were conferring about all these decisions, Ben Bernanke, the New York Fed President Tim Geithner, who's now the Treasury Secretary, and the then Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, do you think they knew how bad it would be when Lehman went down?
I can't imagine they knew how bad it would be. Mr. Bernanke, Geithner, and Paulson knew that the market would be upset if Lehman failed, and they knew that people who had money in Lehman would get hurt. What they didn't realize was how big the ripples would be, almost a tsunami, of people all over the world questioning whether any bank was solvent. I think there were two things about Lehman that were a shock to the system. One is, despite what the officials say, a lot of people in the markets figured that in the end, they would save Lehman. They'd saved Bear Stearns. As one European central banker said to me, in Europe, we don't even let dry cleaners fail. It never occurred to us that the U.S. would let Lehman go. And the second thing, what Lehman had was not just large, it had tentacles all over the world. And so that made it hard to manage, but it also guaranteed that the pain from the Lehman bankruptcy would show up in London, in Paris, in China, in Japan, and that made it much worse.
Now, in 1 year, in 2008, the Fed saved the brokerage house Bear Stearns, helped the Treasury take over mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, let Lehman Brothers go, turned around and rescued the insurance company AIG. And at some point, it became clear that the Fed was expanding its powers, being willing to release billions and billions of dollars into the economy, becoming, as you say in your book, really a fourth branch of government with one man in a position to make all the decisions.
Right. Now, of course, he would say that he couldn't make the decisions alone. There's a committee there. And he would say that Congress has the power to rein in the Fed. And in fact, there's some discussion of it. But at that moment, there was no alternative but the Fed. They did all the things you said. They brought interest rates to zero. When that wasn't enough, they started spending literally hundreds of billions of dollars in buying government bonds and buying mortgage-linked securities in order to keep the economy from starving.
Did they succeed?
We know that the Fed, with some help from the Treasury and the Congress, has succeeded in preventing another Great Depression. The economy has pulled back from the abyss. Did they succeed in getting the economy going again so we can go back to something that resembles normal? Not yet. Did they lay the foundation? Did they plant the seeds for another financial crisis by letting all these investors know that in a pinch, if they lend money to a big financial firm, the government will bail them out? Well, they did that, and we don't know yet whether they are planting the seeds of the next financial crisis.
And Ben Bernanke, do you think, did he do well enough in this crisis to for the president to consider reappointing him? 2010 is the end of his term.
Right. Well, the president's going to decide that, and he's not going to consult me. I think that if the president were making that decision today, he would reappoint him because, one, he's done a good enough job. Two, changing Fed chairman at a time like this could create some uncertainty and doubt in the markets, and that could raise interest rates and hurt the economy, which is weak. And third, I suspect the president will realize that if he puts someone from his team in charge of the Fed, that will lead to suspicions that he's trying to muscle the Fed or help them keep the deficits going or create inflation or all sorts of perceptions that he won't want to create.
David Wessel, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel's new book is called In Fed We Trust. You can read an excerpt at thenewnpr.org, where you can also learn more about the economy on our Planet Money blog.
Mortgage company executives met today with government officials in Washington. They tried to come up with new ways to reduce the rate of foreclosures. As Chris Arnold just told us, an awful lot of borrowers are still losing their homes despite the Obama administration's best efforts to stem that tide. Nevada has been especially hard hit by foreclosures. So to better understand that, we called Gail Burks. She is president of the Nevada Fair Housing Center in Las Vegas. And Ms. Burks, the federal government has helped some 200,000 people stay out of foreclosure in the last few months, but far more borrowers are losing their homes still. Why isn't the government effort more effective? What do you see there on the ground?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, and we discussed this at a meeting here in Las Vegas with U.S. Treasury officials, Fannie Mae officials, and other entities regarding why some of the programs are not effective for Nevada. Initially, for example, those programs did not allow you to go over 105% of loan-to-value. Obviously, because Nevada was so hard hit, people were very upside down and still continue to be. So the refinance pieces for those who may have a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan just didn't work for Nevada. The second thing is lenders. Although over 50 lenders signed up to cooperate and are actually being compensated to modify loans and assist consumers, what actually happens when consumers contact them is a very different story. So it's a combination of things that when you put it all together, it's not as easy as it sounds.
Why is it, then, that the banks are not acting more aggressively to keep people in their homes to stem the tide of foreclosures?
The first thing is I think many servicers don't realize that all real estate is local. So many servicers, when you call their queue, your call could end up any place. It could be in the U.S. It could be out of the country. Second, in some instances, consumers aren't calling their servicer. Some are nervous. Some think there's no help. They sometimes reach out to scam companies. And then third, there is no mandate that servicers work with consumers. Now, in Nevada, we recently had AB 149 that passed that requires a mediation for any foreclosure filed after July 1st. We did that because of the problems that consumers were having in reaching servicers and getting cooperation.
Is it in the bank's best interest, financial interest, to avoid foreclosure?
There are times that it would be in their best interest. For example, some consumers attempt to sell their property and get approval for a short sale. They have an offer, they have a buyer. However, they can't get a response from the lender. That's an example of working with the consumer. They could actually sell that property if they would give an answer as to whether or not that short sale is acceptable. In some instances, consumers could afford the payment and are willing to pay. They just can't pay at the rate and the payment they currently have. Unless you are willing to sit down and analyze the group of consumers that you have in your portfolio, I don't think you can say it's not in my best interest as a general statement.
There are lots and lots of stories about people who would love to live in their house, would love to keep it in some way, but are so underwater with their mortgage that it just doesn't make financial sense to keep on paying and to stay in their house. Is that what you're seeing still in Las Vegas?
We are seeing some consumers where, but for, if they don't get a modification, they are so upside down that it would be in their financial best interest to perhaps go and be a renter. Not every homeowner will be able to save their home. What we all hope for, because it impacts all of us, is that, one, if you can afford to pay and get it adjusted, you would make that attempt. Two, if you just can't afford to pay, then you would return that property in an appropriate way so that there's a minimum amount of impact to the lender, to the economy, to your neighbors, and to you.
What does that mean, return it in an appropriate way?
A voluntary repossession, a deed in lieu of foreclosure, making sure that you walk away appropriately.
Gail Burks is president of the Nevada Fair Housing Center in Las Vegas. Las Vegas has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the nation. Ms. Burks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand in California. I'm filling in for Michelle Norris for a few weeks while she's on book leave.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. And it was about a year ago that oil prices hit a record $147 a barrel. Gasoline prices soared to more than $4 a gallon, with devastating consequences for businesses and consumers. Well, then, in the space of a few months, the price of oil came crashing down. And now some federal regulators are blaming the spike on financial market speculators. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Economists and oil industry analysts are still trying to understand the wild ride that oil prices went on over the past 2 years. And many Democrats pin the blame on speculators. Congressman Bart Stupak of Michigan said the price swings can be tracked to the amount of money put into the markets by large investment funds that specialize in commodities. Stupak came to today's hearing armed with charts.
From January 2008 through the end of June 2008, index speculators poured $55 billion into major commodity indexes, pushing the price of crude oil from $99 per barrel to $140.
Stupak said by the end of the year, prices had plummeted, only to rebound somewhat this year.
You can see prices rise from $35 a barrel to $70 a barrel as index investors came back into the market and put $35 billion into major commodity indexes.
Under the Bush administration, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission had pinned the blame for the volatility on changes in global supply and demand. While speculators had played a part in the price swings, it said, their role was limited. Under the Obama administration, the commission says it wants to re-examine the evidence and perhaps change the way markets are regulated. Right now, energy trading is largely overseen by the markets themselves. If a trader's position gets dangerously large, it trips what's called an accountability level, which means the markets step in to monitor them more closely, and in theory, they can take steps to restrict a trader's activities. One member of the commission, Bart Chilton, said the system doesn't work too well.
But these accountability levels that my colleagues were discussing, they're not very effectual. They're sort of like suggested speed limits on a dark desert highway. They're not really adhered to.
So the chairman of the commission, Gary Gensler, said today that he favors imposing tougher restrictions on the size of traders' holdings as a way of making the oil markets less volatile. But such a move could backfire, says John Kingston, oil director at Platts News Service. He says if U.S. regulators try to restrict traders' activities, they can simply take their business overseas.
The fear here is that this is a very global market, and then if you impose position limits too tight on the energy markets, the traders will just take their ball and go elsewhere. They can basically trade from a country like Switzerland where there are no position limits. They can trade over-the-counter unregulated.
But the head of one major player in the futures markets, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, was more resigned to the possibility of new regulations. He said his exchange would consider limiting traders' positions on its own, essentially sidestepping the government. After the dramatic swings in oil prices that have plagued the economy in recent years, the exchanges are having to shift with the political winds. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.